In fact, it grew even louder as the audience rose from their seats. A standing ovation. Well, isn't that something? For years now, in spite of the success she'd achieved as a reviewer, and in spite of the life she'd made for herself at the Chelsea, Hazel still walked around with a ball of fury deep within her, like a cancer. Fury that she'd never again have the chance to achieve much of anything on the stage, after so much early promise. Unexpectedly, tears sprang to Hazel's eyes. Looking out at these strangers, who stood cheering her on, acknowledging her existence for the first time in 17 years, Hazel realized that her fury was in fact grief. Terrible, inconsolable grief at what could have been. At the loss of her best friend and her theater family in one fell swoop. She swore she wouldn't break. She wouldn't let them see her pain. She'd lived with it this long. But looking out over the crowd who'd gathered tonight to celebrate the splendid world of live theater in all its eccentric, superstitious glory, her heart broke. She stifled a sob with her hand, the suffering of so many years now evident to all, which only made them applaud harder. Hazel looked down at Charlie, who stood with the rest of them, his face beaming. Maxine waited awkwardly by Hazel's side. They should kiss or embrace or something, that's what the crowd wanted. Two best friends, reunited after all these years. Hazel turned to look at Maxine, who had that same silly smile on her face, but her eyes revealed fear. Fear of what Hazel was going to do next. Would she play the game? Or attack her on live television? Hazel's fingers itched. She'd heard that expression 1,000 times before, but never really understood it until now. They itched to physically hurt this woman who'd betrayed her so terribly, who'd left her behind, who was a traitor. As the cheering finally died down, Hazel looked out to Charlie again. He was sitting back down, her empty seat beside him. Something about that unsettled Hazel. But before she had a chance to figure out why, she heard Maxine weeping beside her, her mouth a grimace. The ugly show of emotion dried up Hazel's own tears in a flash. Leave it to Maxine to draw focus on herself when this was supposed to be Hazel's moment. Chewing the scenery, as always, Hazel refused to be upstaged. Not this time. She stepped up to the microphone and took a deep breath. "Thank you for this remarkable and surprising honor." Her voice rebounded up the balconies, up to the rafters, through the cameras and into the homes of millions of Americans. For years now, she'd wanted a way to right all the wrongs, an opportunity to be heard. This was it. Maybe Charlie was right. It was a new era. Perhaps her anguish hadn't been for nothing. Back in 1950, when Wartime Sonata first graced a Broadway stage, we were young and full of hope. We'd won another world war, defeated the enemy, and were the leaders of democracy, of the free world. She didn't want to lecture. How to make her point? Make them understand. It's true that secrets were being ferried out of the country back then, secrets that were shared with the Soviet Union when they should not have been. Brave federal agents hunted for those spies, and they should be commended. She looked down at Charlie. Again, that empty seat beside him nagged at her, reminding her of another time, another empty seat. On the 3rd of July. But then a terrible infection took hold in America, one of paranoia and witch hunts. Others in politics decided to use the fear-mongering as a way to decimate the entertainment industry. They said that communists were poisoning the minds of their children, were out to destroy democracy, and many of you bought the lies. She looked right into the television camera. You didn't question them. You didn't fight back. You let this happen. The entertainment industry was hounded by bullies, as the rest of America, including its top newspapers and news organizations, went along for the ride. The press, who should have exposed the contagion for what it was, let it fester for far too long, cowed by the credentials of the bullies in charge. Because of this, we lost a generation of talent. Screenwriters became typists to earn a buck. Brilliant actors sold shoes to make a living. My friend, Floyd Jenkins, who had so much hope and promise, was forced out of the career he loved because of an offhand remark, then killed himself. Her throat threatened to close up, but she swallowed, took a breath, and kept on. This is how a society is corrupted, from the inside out. We must make a promise to not ever let this happen again. We must promise to be vigilant against our own worst tendencies. Only by doing so will our country sustain its ideals of freedom. She stopped. There was nothing left to say. The men and women in the audience sat for a moment in silence before a wall of sound, of cheers and stamping feet and clapping surged forward. Hazel looked up into the darkness to the very last row of the top balcony, grateful that her message had been heard. She heard Charlie give a whistle, the same one he used to catch a cab, and caught his eye and smiled. Again, the empty seat. On the night that Charlie had asked about, the 3rd of July, Maxine's birthday, they'd gone to a show. Maxine had been harassed by a fan and seemed out of sorts during the first act, fidgeting in her seat. Then she'd disappeared. The seat next to Hazel's had been empty the entire second act. Hazel had emerged from the theater to find Maxine waiting outside, and Arthur right across the street watching them. Just enough time. No, it couldn't be. In shock, Hazel drew back, as if a burst of feedback had screeched out of the microphone that only she could hear. She felt Maxine's hand on her arm, steadying her. Maxine leaned in close, speaking directly into her ear. "I didn't know. I'm sorry about all this." Hazel couldn't speak. Sorry for what? For this muddled award ceremony? Or for worse? She felt Maxine's hand on her waist, guiding her off the stage. "That was a beautiful speech, Hazel," Maxine said. "You've certainly got away with words." Her delivery was wry, playful. She wanted to once again be in Hazel's good graces now that Hazel was back in fashion, but Hazel was having none of it. "I know your secret, Maxine Mead." Her tongue tasted of metal as she spoke. "I know the truth." Chapter 26. Hazel. March 1967. Once backstage, Maxine was swept up in a sea of handlers, leaving Hazel in the wings. Soon enough, though, the stagehands surrounded her, thanking her for her rousing words and shaking her hand. If anything, that was the most gratifying moment so far at this insane awards show, that she'd made the crew proud. More than ever, Hazel wanted Charlie to have a chance to confront Maxine, especially now that Hazel had figured out the truth. But any kind of confrontation was sure to be noticed and covered by the press. This had to be played out very carefully. "Hazel!" Charlie appeared, and she'd never been more relieved to see his face. She waited until they were safely in a taxi, on their way to the post-awards party at the Plaza Hotel, to fill him in. "Maxine was part of it."
"Part of what?"
"Arthur's spy ring. Silver's spy ring. Whatever you want to call him. Arthur is Silver, I'm certain. And Maxine was a spy, too."
Charlie frowned. "Maxine Mead, a spy?"
"That evening, July the 3rd, when we went to the theater, Maxine wasn't with me the entire time. I only realized it when I was on stage giving my speech and saw the empty seat next to you. I remembered that Maxine never returned after the intermission, leaving me alone for the entire second act. I saw her later, outside. I spotted Arthur across the street, watching us, and insisted we all go to dinner so I could finally meet Maxine's mysterious beau. Slow down. I'm not understanding the connection."
Hazel started again, thinking it through as she spoke.
"When we were first entering the theater, a fan waylaid her, a rude one. After that, she seemed flustered, like something was bothering her. She got up as soon as the curtain fell for intermission, told me she was going to the bathroom, but never came back. Later, she said she'd missed the bell and didn't want to make a fuss, scrambling back to her seat in the dark. But I think the fan was connected to Arthur in some way, and had told her to get back to the hotel and let Arthur in through the tunnel. I remember the second act of that play was interminable, which means Maxine had more than enough time to grab a cab and help Silver slash Arthur escape by disappearing into the townhouse, through the tunnel, and out the hotel's front door. Then they jumped in a cab back to the theater district."
She sat back, pleased. What if she just missed the bell?
When he said it like that, the story did seem improbable. Still, I don't think it's just a coincidence. Arthur treated Maxine terribly. He hit her, abused her, but she never left, which didn't seem like Maxine at all. The Maxine Mead we knew would have dumped a loser like that in an instant. Whenever I questioned her, she'd say that she loved him, but there was something empty in the words, like she didn't really believe them. I always thought there was something odd going on, but I could never put my finger on it. Now it makes sense. Arthur and she were more than lovers. They were both spies, which was why she couldn't escape his clutches. Or maybe she really didn't want to. She let out a sharp laugh. To think I just made a speech chastising those who were paranoid about spies when one may have been standing right beside me. What did you say to her as you were going off stage? Charlie asked. I told her that I knew the truth. She should have never let on, but she couldn't help herself. Do you think I've ruined your opportunity? What if she runs for the hills? He considered it. She's too famous. She has to show up at the party and probably thinks it's safer in a crowd. We have to figure out a way to get her alone. It's better if I do it. It's the only chance that she'll open up. You're not trained. No way. She's emotional, vulnerable, and we have a long history. I've got this, I promise. Inside the ballroom, there's a long balcony that overlooks the room. I'll lead her up there for a private talk, and you take the opposite stairs and sneak over. Don't let her see you, though, or we'll lose our chance. A band played as they entered the grand ballroom of the Plaza Hotel, a space that would have looked at home in Versailles, with its gold-leaf plaster and mighty columns. They were escorted to a table where Lauren Bacall and Carol Burnett sat engrossed in conversation. "Well, this will be easy." Hazel pointed to the placards, where she and Maxine were seated next to each other. For a brief moment, she doubted herself. Maybe she was just jazzed up with adrenaline from the unexpected turn of events, indulging in conspiracy theories. But the guilty look on Maxine's face after she'd spoken the words out loud was undeniable. She'd known what was going on, one way or another.
"Excuse me, coming through?"
An older man, Hazel recognized as Maxine's agent, pulled out a chair. Maxine, behind him, didn't take it. Instead, she froze when faced with Hazel and Charlie. Her mouth opened and closed a couple of times, but no sound came out.
"Max, it's been too long."
Charlie leaned over and gave her a kiss on the cheek. Maxine responded with an enigmatic smile.
"Look at that. The gang's back together. Lovely to see you, Charlie."
Just then, a couple of photographers pushed Charlie aside.
"We need a photo of the two of you, Miss Ripley and Miss Mead."
Hazel put her arm around Maxine's waist and drew her close. "Say cheese." After a couple of flashes, Maxine tried to pull away, but Hazel spoke through gritted teeth. "Come with me. We have to talk." To her surprise, Maxine softened in her arms. "Fine." They cut through the surging crowd and up a wide set of stairs. Hazel unhooked the velvet rope that limited access to the balcony and let Maxine through before clicking it back in place behind them. Once they reached the top, Maxine moved into the shadows, out of the view of the crowd below. "I'm so sorry about this evening, Hazel. I had no idea they were going to pull that stunt. I would have never agreed if I'd known. But your speech was marvelous. I hope you know that."
"Don't flatter me."
"I'm not. It's the truth." Her hand fluttered to her hair, a nervous tic Hazel knew well. Better to get straight to the point.
"Maxine, I know about your activities with Arthur."
Out of the corner of her eye, she saw Charlie approaching. He stayed glued to the wall, out of Maxine's line of vision, but well within earshot.
"My activities?"
Her pretend innocence infuriated Hazel. She couldn't hold back. "You were a spy, just like Arthur was. You were spying on all of us. How could you?"
"I wasn't spying on you. What on earth are you talking about?"
Her face was open, childlike, confused. What if Hazel was completely wrong about all this and had simply gotten caught up in the drama of the evening? She charged on anyway.
"I know it all, Maxine. I know that Arthur was known as Silver, that he was at the top of a network of spies that included Julius Rosenberg. You were his protégé."
A leap of faith, that last statement, but Maxine wouldn't know it was just a guess.
"No, that's not true. None of that is true."
The words came out robotic, the worst line reading ever. Hazel softened her voice, let her hands fall to her sides. That was all a long time ago, Max. A lot has changed since then, we all know that. I'm just trying to make sense of it all. We all did what we could to get through in a terrible time. I want to hear your side of it. Maxine responded with a tiny sigh. The air around them shifted, and Maxine's face went slack, not with fear, but with relief. Hazel suspected she was desperate to confide her side of the story. "You can tell me, Maxine," said Hazel. "It's water under the bridge. After all this time, I deserve the truth. That's why you stayed with Arthur, right? Even though he was a beast, I realize now that you didn't have a choice." Her gaze flickered. "I wanted to tell you for so long that I couldn't. It would put you in danger. But hell, let's be honest, I didn't have the courage." Maxine paused. "I met Arthur, like I told you, long ago when I was still in Seattle. I didn't realize it until later that he was grooming me, training me from the very beginning. I was young, a teenager, and he was powerful and smart. I thought I was in love. With him, with the Communist Party, the two were one in my mind." "Did he bring you to New York?" "Yes. I was sent there to work as an agent. Soon after, I was told I'd been made a member of the Underground. It was an honor. It meant they regarded me as important. It also meant I cut off all contact with regular communists, didn't go to meetings, distanced myself from the party. Not even the communists knew I was a communist." A terrible realization dawned. "What really happened with you and my brother? Was he trying to recruit you, or was it the other way around?" Maxine's face crumpled. "He was on our list of potential recruits. I was told to get a sense of where his political sympathies lay, but when he took me to that protest, I was completely blindsided. That was exactly the type of scene I was supposed to avoid, being deep underground. I let him go after that. I told them that he was too patriotic, that he wouldn't be turned." Hazel wasn't sure whether to believe her or not. In fact, she was having a difficult time aligning the woman before her, someone who had been trained to lie and scheme, with the changeable drama queen she'd met in Naples and practically lived with in New York. Which one was the real Maxine? Hazel backtracked, returning Maxine to more comfortable territory. "Did they make you join the USO tour?" "They thought it'd be a good way to monitor what was going on in Europe, but the controls were too strict. I couldn't get word back to Arthur. So, for a time, I was told to cut off all communication. That was the first taste of what it's like to be a normal person. When we met, when we were trying to help Paul, that was all true. You know that, right?" Hazel stayed silent. "After the war, I went back to California to help them infiltrate the film industry. But after I lost the part to Marilyn Monroe, they sent me to New York to try to revitalize my career on the stage. In my play."
"Yes, in your play."
Maxine's voice trembled. "It was a calculated move on their behalf, but I wanted to play Lena more than anything. It was a beautiful part, the best I've ever had. Then Julius Rosenberg was arrested and everything fell to pieces. Arthur came up with the idea to use you and Charlie as a diversion once the show had opened to raves. But I couldn't let them do that to you and Charlie, so I... She trailed off. The image of Maxine standing on that stage, floundering like an amateur, came to mind. "Oh, my God," said Hazel. "You threw the show. On purpose." "I was protecting you. How?" "I hated to do it, Hazel, I swear. I figured by screwing up, I'd get you out of the spotlight, keep you out of Arthur's reach." Her excuses enraged Hazel. "I had one chance. Only one, and you ruined it." Maxine shuddered. "I wasn't in my right mind." "What about the evening of your birthday?" Hazel demanded. "That was the night you helped Arthur escape, right?" She nodded slowly, surprised. "An operative followed me to the theater, said I had to return to the hotel and let in Arthur through the townhouse, that the feds were closing in on him." "That man who wanted your autograph?" "Yes. So I left at intermission, took a cab there, let Arthur in, and then he insisted on coming back to the theater with me. I was trapped." Playing the victim again, Hazel couldn't stand it. "So after all that, you not only flopped the show, you still set me and Charlie up that day in the hotel. You told the photographers where to find us and ruined Charlie's career as well." "No, I had nothing to do with it. My guess is Arthur stole my stationery and wrote that note. You have to believe me." Hazel tried to conjure up the memory of the note, what the handwriting had looked like, but it had been so long ago. I don't know what to believe anymore. You can't deny that you named names. I had to. You don't understand. No one had to. Sure, you might have not had the career you do now. You might have been destitute like me, but you didn't have to. Hazel started to laugh in spite of herself. Maxine looked at her like she was mad. Maybe she was. What's so funny? Asked Maxine. I'm picturing you being questioned by Roy Cohn, and how he had an actual spy right there, right in the room with him, and didn't even know it. The incompetency of it all. Maxine didn't crack a smile. I went in there thinking it was just about paperwork, and then I'd be on my way, but they started questioning me, and yes, I had a lot to hide. As Cohn dug in deeper, I panicked. I never meant to name anyone, never, but they knew my weak spot. They threatened to deport my grandmother if I didn't cooperate and tell them what they wanted. Acid dripped from Hazel's voice. You poor dear. I'm sorry for everything, I really am. I was trying to protect you, protect my family. Hazel would have none of it. You've been living large on other people's pain for years now. I tried to help. I took the job in Hollywood so that I could support you, make it up to you. I figured by burning bright I could escape Arthur's grip and free myself from being a Soviet agent, and it worked. Once I was out, I could take care of you. Take care of me? What are you talking about? I had an arrangement with Mr. Bard, and later his son, that I would pay your rent every month. I wanted you to share in the spoils. I knew I didn't deserve it. Hazel burst out laughing. You're an idiot! Stanley Bard must have been pocketing your blood money for years now. I've never seen a penny. I paid what rent I could and worked the switchboard when I couldn't. You never received it? But that was the whole point. Maxine's words faded away into the general noise of the party going on below them. She put one hand on the wall to steady herself. Charlie stepped forward. We'll need you to tell the FBI everything you know. Maxine's knees seemed to buckle at the sound of his voice, but she caught herself and recovered. Charlie? For a split second, the vamp from Naples reappeared, all smiles and charm. What are you doing, eavesdropping on a lady's private conversation? Charlie works in the government now. Maxine snapped to attention. Huh, I see. I've been set up. She turned to Charlie, her voice ragged. It's all meaningless. I was a nobody, really. Then you make a statement to that effect, said Charlie. The cables that were passed between spies and the Soviet Union are still being decoded and analyzed. It's important that you share what you know. Hazel cut in. Is your grandmother still your excuse? No, she died years ago. There's no one left to protect. She looked at Charlie, then over at Hazel. Hazel, I would have never hurt you. Anything I did was so that you wouldn't get caught up in it, that you wouldn't get hurt. But it was bigger than I could have imagined. You seem to have made out pretty well in the bargain. For all intents and purposes, you're a huge success. No, I'm completely alone. I haven't let anyone else into my life since then. I was too nervous that they'd come after me all over again, come after the people I love. There's no one left. You're the success, Hazel.
Is that so?
Please, enlighten me.
You stood tall when everyone else was caving in. Don't you see? That's why you were honored tonight. All the trappings of fame mean nothing. Not when you've sold your soul.
How easy to say, when you're the one living the dream. Maxine straightened and looked over at Charlie. It was over, and she knew it. Let me get my affairs in order this evening, and I'll come to you first thing in the morning. You'll get your due, I promise. Charlie nodded. Hazel stared at him in disbelief.
You're going to just let her walk out of here? Are you crazy?
She has nowhere to hide, Hazel. Her plan worked for the Russians, and it works for us, too. She's too big of a star. One night won't make a difference. Right, Maxine?
Hazel didn't wait for Maxine to respond. Once again, you're leaving destruction in your wake. I make the speech of my life, and then tomorrow you go out there, front and center, and admit to being a spy. Take up the spotlight. You really know how to cap me at my knees every time, don't you?
Maxine began to cry.
No, that's not what this is. Remember Naples?
when we did so much good for the soldiers, made them forget where they were for a little while. Same at the Chelsea Hotel, running lines and working on the play. I had that glorious feeling of freedom and creativity and not having any chains to hold us down. You will have your time in the spotlight. You are brilliant and your play is brilliant. Everyone will see that now.
Maxine's facade, the one built on movie star glamour and a breathless beauty, had completely slipped away. She looked faded and lost.
"I'll accept my responsibility, I promise," said Maxine softly. "I'll do whatever I can."
Chapter 27. Maxine. March 27, 1967. The worst with Arthur was when we were driving somewhere together and he asked me to pull out the huge atlas and figure out the directions. It didn't matter if we were cruising around the Hollywood Hills or looking for some unmarked door in Queens to make a drop-off. The very request would get my heart pumping like I was running alongside the car, not sitting in the passenger seat. I would look up the name of the street in the back as quickly as I could, then locate the appropriate square on the map, but I was never fast enough. Looking back, I can see that he got great pleasure in flustering me, in getting angrier and angrier until he was screaming at me to tell him which way to turn, swearing until I wept. He'd apologize afterward, and I'd stupidly presume that the balance of power had shifted over to me, which generated a rush that was probably equal to his own. The same rush I felt when I passed off secret documents, or raced to the Chelsea Hotel to rescue Arthur. Arthur was my life. I had attached to him like one of those round-mouthed fishes on a shark, and I wasn't going anywhere. This is no excuse for what I went on to do, for having ruined the lives of the people I loved, but being kept off balance like that was a terrible, terrible fate. Never mind walking on eggshells. I tiptoed on shards of glass whenever he was around. I was so eager to please and never quite measured up. I placed my passion in our mission, in our cause, to prove to him that I was worthy of his love. I thought I had reason to hate the same things Arthur did. Capitalism. American greed. Only later did I realize I was viewing my life through Arthur's particularly warped perspective, as if we were standing in front of a funhouse mirror that elongated certain truths and shortened others. Magnéard. An ugly name, he'd told me. He only used it when he was angry at me, hitting the consonants hard with contempt. I wonder who she might have become, this Magnéard, if she hadn't been twisted into Maxine Mead. Instead, I became a follower, content to do what other people told me to do. As an actress, that worked in my favor. If a director told me to cry, I cried. Laugh? Done. I could bring any emotion up from my very bones and let it cascade through my mouth, my eyes, so that you knew exactly what I was thinking. Or what you thought I was thinking. It's kept me employed for a long time, eons in this industry. I graduated from dishy ingenue to wisecracking dame, and that's perfectly fine with me. More substance to play with, even if the lines are fewer. Shooting movies suits me, as the cast bonds like long-lost family members for the course of a couple of months and says goodbye at the wrap party with giddy promises to be in touch, but never does. I have the illusion of being part of something without the closeness. I've missed Hazel terribly these past many years, missed being able to pop down the hall and have a laugh, to meet at El Quixote for a drink after a long day of rehearsal, and let all the insanity fade away. That's what good friends do. All that stuff that builds in your head into something terribly important that might bring you down at any moment, It dissipates when you see each other, turns into feathers that float away. Seeing Hazel on stage, standing just a few feet away from me, had almost been more than I could handle. There she was, my dearest friend, yet she might as well have been a total stranger. Sure, she looked terrible, in dire need of a makeover, but I adored the fact that she didn't care. That was my Hazel, all right. She was fierce in her gray streaks and her blazing eyes, and I wanted to hold her in my arms and tell her how much I loved her, how much I'd missed her. To my surprise, after that terrible confrontation with Charlie and Hazel, they let me go. It would have been better if they'd hauled me away, right then and there. Instead, I went back down to the party and drank whatever came my way, until my agent guided me upstairs to my room and told me to get some rest, closing the door behind him. I didn't do what he said. I ripped off my gown and put on some dungarees and a sweater. The clock said 2 a.m, but I wasn't tired. This was my last evening of freedom before my carefully constructed world came crashing down, and I wouldn't waste a second of it. I pulled on a hat with a wide brim and caught a cab downtown. We cut through Times Square, where the lights were still as bright as ever. Part of the reason I'd been a good actress, and how funny that I'm already speaking in the past tense, was that I had a terrible fear of disappearing, of being a nobody. That's what I thought the party was all about. That's why I fought so hard for a country that I'd never been to. Because communism stood for everyone taking care of each other, for being valuable and worthy, being equals. In the intervening years, we were all proven wrong. Wrong that I was valuable, and wrong that communism would protect us from economic ruin or fanatical leaders. Stalin killed millions who disagreed with him. They simply disappeared. For a long time, I denied the reports, unwilling to believe such a thing. But even the most authoritarian government can't evade the truth. It rises like steam from the fissures of a volcano. Still, the world is run by men who want power, who will say anything to attain it, and do anything to retain it. Outwardly, I was Hollywood royalty. Inside, I was a nobody, just like Arthur had said. I had the taxi pull up on the far side of 23rd Street, the Chelsea Hotel, where I'd been embraced and felt safe, where non-conformists were the norm. When I came back to New York for a quick visit a few years ago, I put on glasses and a scarf and watched from the bar across the street until I saw Hazel appear. She walked to the newspaper stand, exchanged a word with the owner, then down the street to buy flowers, before disappearing back through the lobby doors. I knew exactly what vase she'd put them in, the white ceramic one with the narrow neck. I missed her so much. This evening, I could see a few lights on, even at this late hour. Not surprising, in a building full of artists and musicians. I crossed the street and entered the lobby, which had hardly changed. There were more paintings on the walls, and some kind of awful papier-mâché sculpture hung from the ceiling, but these were hardly a distraction from the room's decaying Victorian splendor. A man behind the counter looked up from a dirty magazine. Suddenly, I was so tired. I motioned to one of the couches. "Do you mind if I sit here a moment? I'm waiting for someone," I lied. He shrugged. "Do whatever you like." If David Bard had still been alive, he would most likely have been up at this hour, overseeing a midnight installation of new carpet in the hallways so as to avoid paying union wages or some other ridiculous enterprise. He would have sat with me and talked on and on about the hotel, filled me in on the latest gossip. That would have been nice. What was I doing here? I wasn't sure. I suppose I wanted to feel part of Hazel's world one last time. The lobby door opened, and a couple of young rockers stomped by in matching black boots. The girl, who had acne-scarred skin and a head of blonde corkscrew curls, turned and scrutinized me. "Hey, I know you." I shook my head and pulled my hat lower. By now, the booze was beginning to wear off. I'd have a terrible headache soon. "I don't think so." "Sure, you're that lady. My mom loves your movies." I nodded but didn't answer. Luckily, her boyfriend hadn't broken his stride, and she hurried off to catch up. A minute or so later, a high scream echoed down the stairwell, tapering off to a muffled yelp. I moved to the edge of the couch, ready to spring into action, but the desk clerk didn't even look up. "Is everything all right?" I asked. He stared at me as if I were the one who'd screamed. "Some junkie's having a fight. Nothing I can do about it." I worried about Hazel living in a place like this. It no longer had the innocuous, creative vibe of the 50s. Today, a different kind of creature lurked about, desperate and dangerous. I wished I had the courage to get up and knock on Hazel's door, insist she invite me in, tell her that I loved her. The clock said 5 in the morning. I had 4 hours before I was due to be at the address Charlie had given me, downtown in Foley Square. In spite of the changes, it felt good to sit in the Chelsea, to feel part of the hotel once again. I thought of all the people who'd found their creative muse here, created poetry and plays, music and art. I had missed out on the best of it by heading to Hollywood. Missed Mark Rothko, Dylan Thomas, Arthur Miller, Jack Kerouac. What if I'd stayed and not headed west to the antiseptic wasteland of Los Angeles? I could have been part of the legend of the Chelsea Hotel, like Hazel would be once her play was revived on Broadway and her career resurrected. No chance of that now for me. I rose and approached the counter. "Can I get a room?" He looked at the wall of keys and plucked one from it. "How long you staying?"
"Just for one night."
"It'll be $28.17. "That seems like a very arbitrary figure." "Just saying what's in the book here."
"That's fine."
I pulled the bills out of my wallet and counted out the change. "You got any luggage? I can call a porter to take it up for you."
I shook my head. "I'm traveling light these days." I put my hand in my coat pocket, checking that my second most important possession was still there. It was. The most important one was in my satchel, my diary, which I'd kept writing even after turning over the earlier pages to Lavinia. How ironic that Hazel didn't write anymore, yet I'd never been able to stop.
"The room's on the second floor. You can take the elevator or the stairs."
"I know the way."
Room 225 was in the west wing of the building, the door located off a side hallway. The hotel had been carved up since I'd been in it, larger suites divided into two, more profit and less space. The chamber lacked all of the glorious details of my old room, with just a twin bed and side table squeezed between two dingy walls. Something sharp had sliced through the lampshade, leaving a 6-inch vertical scar. The stained glass transom above the door was the only reminder of the hotel's original elegance. I reached into my coat pocket and pulled out the bottle of pills, placing them carefully on the side table next to a smudged water glass. I carried the glass down the hallway to the shared bathroom and filled it up to the top. Then back to my room. All was silent. The night sky outside the window had turned from turgid black to a dark gray. The sun wouldn't be up for another couple of hours. I could feel the ghosts of the hotel gathering around me, keeping vigil. I closed the curtain, a dusty damask that had seen better days, and sat back down on the bed. I undid the bottle, took a couple of pills in my hand, swallowed them down, took a couple of pills, swallowed, over and over until there were none left. As I lay down on the bed, waiting for whatever was going to come next, a memory of my grandmother giving me a pill when I was sick came back to me. She'd crush the white tablet into a chalky powder and mix it with raspberry jam on a spoon. The pill was bitter, as I'd known it would be, but the sweetness of the berries and the pretty way they glistened on the spoon overrode my distaste. I wished I had a jar of raspberry jam next to me now and a spoon to taste it with. If only I had that. If only.
Chapter 28. Hazel, March 1967. Hazel put on her most comfortable shoes and skipped the elevator. It was stuck on the second floor again, and instead plodded down the stairs around and around, her hand gliding along the banister to the ground floor. After Charlie had dropped her off in front of the Chelsea last night, she'd yanked off her gown, not even bothering to hang it up. She'd never wear the dress again. It was as though it had been stained by Maxine's denials and excuses, invisible damage that only Hazel could see. Sleep had finally come as the sun rose, and she'd awakened abruptly at 10 to the garish ring of the alarm, checking the hands of the clock in panic, like a schoolgirl who'd missed an exam. By now, Charlie would be with Maxine at the Bureau's field office in Foley Square. Walking west until she could go no farther, Hazel turned south, the Hudson River sluicing along on her right and the crumbling elevated highway to her left. Not the most peaceful stroll, but she liked the idea that she was getting some fresh air, even if she was sandwiched between car exhaust and polluted waters. Before she'd headed out, the phone had rung. It was Stanley, saying that he'd watched the Tonys and loved her speech. She'd thanked him before explaining that she wouldn't be moving from her room and that he'd have to find somewhere else to put his rock band. She was done with getting pushed around by anyone. He'd quickly agreed and asked how Maxine was, said that they'd looked swell together on stage. She thanked him and hung up. Maxine. The panicked look in her eyes last night had haunted Hazel in her sleep. They'd cornered her. What a fall from the brash, brassy woman Hazel had met in Naples, who owned the joint and made no bones about it, the one who fearlessly drove a jeep into a frenzied crowd in order to save a couple of frightened boys, whom Hazel had once considered her best friend in the world. She'd said she thought she was protecting Hazel. The way Maxine spun it, she'd tried to deflect dangerous attention away from Hazel. If only she'd opened up and told Hazel what was going on, about the depths of the abuse by Arthur. Hazel had witnessed his crass bullying firsthand and hadn't done enough, hadn't said enough. She should have insisted that Maxine leave him, taken her somewhere safe and out of his clutches. Maybe that would have changed things. But she could never have guessed the wicked winds that were swirling around them both. And Arthur was a master at turning on the charisma, at hiding his true self, just as he'd done over dinner that warm summer evening, all shy smiles and self-flagellation. Another call came through soon after she hung up with Stanley, this time from her agent, a husky-voiced woman who hadn't reached out to her in years. "Do you have a play ready to go? We're getting lots of inquiries." She didn't wait for an answer. "The Coast will want to know if you have any screenplays. Do you have any screenplays?" Hazel had agreed to come into her office for a meeting that afternoon. Over the past many years, a number of ideas had floated by, before dissipating in a puff of disapproval of her own making. Nothing had clicked. But even with all the newfound approbation, she knew better than to rush the process. She would never be bullied again, either by a movie producer or by a corrupt politician. That much she knew. Her life hadn't been the happiest, but it had been full. and Hazel was finally ready to appreciate that. Maxine and Hazel's early definition of success, which had left Maxine corrupt, lost, and alone, would no longer be hers. This latest interest in Hazel's work could be as fleeting as the last, but she would do this on her own terms, relying on the grit and courage she'd always had. The rest of them be damned. This time around, she'd please herself first. If that didn't make the grade with the critics or audience, so be it. She just needed an idea. A good one. She also had Charlie back, possibly. Seeing him again had brought on a rush of emotions, one that she'd never felt for any of her other lovers. He'd kissed her lightly on the mouth as he dropped her off. "You're remarkable," he'd said. "I know," she responded, which made him laugh. "You are, too, for sticking with this spy hunt for years and years. I knew it was my way back to you." But she was getting ahead of herself, thinking about all that. Hazel stopped and stared out at the cliffs of New Jersey. She wondered when she'd hear next from Charlie, maybe when they took a break for lunch. Turning back home, she picked up the pace. When she was writing the first draft of Wartime Sonata, a walk by the water always helped her overcome whatever obstacle was bothering her, whether a weak plot point or a particular turn of phrase that needed to be fine-tuned. She'd enjoyed those early, quiet days in the hotel when she felt she was part of something larger. A ship, Wanda or Winifred had called it. A ship of fools, maybe, but at least they were trying to achieve something great, even if everyone was rowing in a different direction. That was when she'd soared. Poor Maxine, and how strange that Hazel was already forgiving her a tiny, tiny bit, imagining the terror she'd gone through at the hands of that brute Arthur, never had that chance. She'd never found her own center, always struggling to please everyone around her. Hazel's lingering jealousy and resentment of Maxine's success were slowly chipping away, like flakes of marble from a statue. In spite of it all, Hazel's moral center had held, and she'd stayed true to her beliefs and values when so many others hadn't, just as Maxine had remarked last night. Approaching 8th Avenue, Hazel considered what forgiveness might look like. Could she forgive a friend who had ruined her, all in the guise of protecting her? It hadn't been a guise. Maxine's whimpered pleas last night, with the party raging below them, came from a dark, dreadful place. She'd done some terrible things. No doubt Charlie could set Hazel straight on that front once they were done interrogating her. But she'd gotten tangled in the machinery of an organization that was much stronger than she was. Outside the hotel, an ambulance had pulled up to the curb, and Hazel's heart flipped. Over the past several years, she'd gotten used to seeing the elderly residents being trundled into the back of an ambulance and never reappearing. Give it a few decades, and she would be the one being transported off to an old folks' home, having fallen and broken a hip, losing her dignity and independence in one fell swoop. But right now, her first concern was Lavinia. The front door opened and a stretcher appeared, the body on it covered with a blanket. Behind the stretcher walked a young man in a leather jacket next to a woman with frizzy curls. Hazel stopped them. "Do you know who it is?" The woman snapped her gum. "It was one of the transients, not a permanent, someone who was only here for the night." Relief settled through Hazel. Another drug addict, probably. Last year, a drug dealer had been shot dead on the fourth floor. Stanley denied it ever happened. If anyone asked, he said the man they'd seen slumped in the stairway in a pool of blood had just been taking a nap, before quickly changing the subject. "Someone famous," offered the woman. The man looked annoyed. "Come on, we gotta go." "Did they say who?" Hazel asked. The woman considered the question, much to the irritation of the man. "She was an actress from the 1950s. She looked at her boyfriend. "What was her name?" He shrugged and stared off down the street. Her face lit up with a dopey joy. "I remember. It was Trixie something." A shiver ran through Hazel. Now the man was engaged. "No, stupid. Her name was Maxine." "Whatever." The woman turned back to Hazel. "I saw her sitting here in the lobby last night, just hanging out at like 4 in the morning. So sad." Hazel's breath came in short gasps. She struggled for air. It couldn't be possible. Maxine was downtown with Charlie. The ambulance had already pulled away. Hazel rushed inside the hotel, almost slipping on the floor as she made the sharp turn into Stanley's office. The radiator hissed with steam in the too warm room. Stanley was behind his desk, rifling through a drawer. He looked up when she came in, and from the expression on his face, she knew it was true. What happened?
I didn't even know she'd checked back in until this morning. The police said they found an empty pill bottle by her bed. This is terrible. The hotel will get a macabre reputation. I'm trying to make this into a decent, respectable residence, and now this. How could Maxine have done this to me?
Hazel knew the answer. As she spoke, her voice broke. She wanted to come home. Hazel waited up on the roof for Charlie, shaking. He'd called soon after she'd arrived back at her room, and she'd told him the reason Maxine had never shown up to her appointment. After hanging up, she had to get out of this room, where every corner held some memory of Maxine, dancing around with a martini glass in hand, or pacing back and forth as she ran her lines, stamping a foot whenever Hazel corrected her or had to give her a cue.
"Really, the script is terrible," she'd joke. "God knows where they found this playwright."
The memories crashed down on her. The two of them, in the ruins of Naples, backstage at the Biltmore, in the safety of the Chelsea, where Maxine had found her final refuge. The night before, while Hazel had been upstairs, staring up at the water-stained ceiling and trying to sleep, Maxine had been sitting down in the lobby. Had she approached the desk clerk to ask him to ring up, but then decided not to? If only Hazel had known. Charlie burst through the roof door. Hazel ran to him, sobbing. "We killed her!" "No. She made some terrible decisions, one after another, including taking her own life."
"I wanted to forgive her eventually. She was the first person to believe in me. She gave me the confidence to write and direct. I'd forgotten that, in all of the resentment and betrayal."
Who knew what Maxine could have become if she hadn't met Arthur at such a young age? But Hazel would never know the answer to that. And in spite of it all, Maxine had shined on stage, been brilliant on film. Her talent was undeniable.
What a terrible waste.
Hazel wiped her eyes. A terrible waste. Chapter 29. Hazel. April 1967. A memorial for Maxine was held at St. Malachy's on West 49th Street, a neo-Gothic sanctuary long considered the spiritual haven of New York actors, where Douglas Fairbanks married Joan Crawford and where Rudolph Valentino's funeral mass drew thousands. Maxine's memorial didn't draw quite as many spectators, but Hazel was sure she would have been pleased with the turnout. Hazel sat next to Lavinia's wheelchair near the back of the church. Curiously, the grand show of emotion by the people who barely knew Maxine canceled out any grief of her own for those 2 hours. After, she wheeled Lavinia back up to her room at the Chelsea, both of them eager to get out of the public eye. Only once they were back in the safety of the hotel did Hazel curl up on one of Lavinia's armchairs and weep, a messy mix of sobs and crumpled tissues. So much had been lost.
"Oh, Maxine would have loved all this drama," said Lavinia, patiently pouring out 2 cups of tea.
Hazel laughed in spite of herself.
"Yes, she would have been very pleased."
She took a sip of tea and regarded her friend.
"I have to ask you a question, Lavinia. Did you know she was a Soviet agent?"
Lavinia pursed her lips and didn't answer right away.
"I had moments when I thought she was, and others when I didn't. She was a changeable creature, and she came from a tumultuous time."
She pulled a handkerchief out of her sleeve and wiped away a tear of her own.
"It was grand watching you both on the television, on the Tonys. What a speech you made! I've never been prouder.
But I didn't think it would end quite like this. I feel terrible."
"None of this is your fault. Please don't blame yourself." Charlie had told Hazel that with no official confession on record, the FBI had no real proof, so Maxine's treasonous activities wouldn't be made public. However, they had apprehended Arthur this morning in a raid and taken him into custody. The spy hunt was over.
I have something for you, Hazel. Lavinia waved a hand at two packages that sat on her dining room table. One I received directly from Maxine the day she fled the Chelsea for California back in 1950. The other a porter brought to me this morning. Apparently Maxine left it on the nightstand last night, with my name on it.
Then you should have them.
In her note, she insisted they were both meant for you.
Reluctantly, Hazel took the packages up to her room. For the rest of the day, she ignored them. It wasn't until the sun began to set that she poured herself a scotch, untied the string on the package that was noticeably older, the brown paper crinkled and thin, and began to read. It was the first half of Maxine's diary, beginning in Naples in 1945, a detailed account of her creative endeavors, both theatrical and treasonous. The other package continued on after her final move to California. It took Hazel a few days to get through all the pages, as she often had to stop and step away, catch her breath. Maxine's accounts of her triumphs and failures were vivid. Her fear leaped off every page, of being caught, of being discovered, of losing Hazel's friendship. It was almost as if Maxine were still alive. Hazel always believed, deep down, that they'd find each other again someday. They'd be somewhere around Lavinia's age, wobbly and croaky, but their prior tribulations would have smoothed over with time, like a rocky shore that's been reduced to clattering pebbles. Maxine would move back down the hall at the Chelsea Hotel, begging forgiveness at every turn, and Hazel would pretend to hold out, but not really. They'd come back together. Instead, Maxine had left Hazel alone to try to unravel the truth from the lies. She'd snatched away the possibility of reconciliation, and Hazel wanted to hate her for it. But really, she hated herself for being cruel and not knowing how broken Maxine was, how desperate. Hazel sat at her desk, staring dumbly at the sheaf of papers. To think, while Hazel had struggled with writer's block, her friend had been scribbling away all these years, day after day. Hazel laughed out loud, the sound a solemn echo. Maxine had always pushed her to the precipice, whether onto a stage in Naples or to mount and direct her own play. At the same time, Maxine was pushing herself, straddling two worlds and rising to the top in one while successfully escaping the other. Hazel couldn't blame Maxine for getting caught up in a cause. After all, she'd done it herself, at Ben's urging. But Maxine had fallen into a nasty web of characters, while Hazel had not. In spite of it all, Maxine had done what she could to take care of Hazel, including that ham-fisted attempt to protect her on opening night. There were more shades of gray to Maxine's existence than Hazel had been able to see previously. With this diary, Hazel finally understood the larger struggle beneath the betrayal. If Maxine were here right now, standing next to her, what would she say? She'd tell Hazel to stop whining and write another play already. "Get on with it," she'd snap, "and meet me on the roof at sunset." Hazel placed her palm on the top page. What a story lived within these words. A rip-roaring plot in three acts. Naples, the McCarthy reign of terror, the tragic aftermath, and what could have been. The last ray of sunlight shone on her typewriter, and she idly tapped the space bar. What if? She slid a blank piece of paper into the roller, her hand feeling as if it was being guided by someone else's. A play in three acts, one that would speak of Maxine's legacy, both good and bad. The story of a friendship. Hazel began typing. Epilogue. The sound of typing draws the ghosts close, watching, nodding. The woman, their newest member, stands apart, weeping. She cries in grief because her absence is so much worse than what she'd escaped. She cries in happiness to see her friend, head bent forward, furiously typing away once again. Her friend would have forgiven her. The ghost understands that now, but it's too late. They will not embark on this new journey together. She cries for all the souls of the Chelsea Hotel, who climbed the stairs, opened the door, and found their way home. As she has now.
Author's note. For over a decade, beginning in 1947, the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, set out to rid the entertainment industry of suspected communists. The names of individuals accused of being members of the Communist Party were compiled on index cards, a stack that ultimately stretched 10 feet high. During those terrible years, careers were derailed, finances drained, and lives destroyed. Although this is a work of fiction, I hewed closely to the stories of several blacklisted artists. For example, much of Hazel's experience with the HUAC parallels writer-director Lillian Hellman's, as described in her memoir, Scoundrel Time. The publications Red Channels and Counterattack, as well as the organization American Business Consultants, existed, as did Vince Hartnett and, of course, Roy Cohn. The character of Lawrence Butterfield is based on Syracuse grocer Lawrence A. Johnson, who threatened to lead boycotts of programs that hired blacklisted artists, demands to which the advertising firms of Madison Avenue readily yielded. The despicable clearance industry, described in the novel, where artists could pay the people who blacklisted them to get exonerated, is also factual. Books that proved vital to my research include Inside the Dream Palace by Cheryl Tippins, Naming Names by Victor S. Navasky, Unfriendly Witness by Millie S. Berenger, Red Spy Queen by Catherine S. Olmsted, Red Channels, The Bible of Blacklisting by Jason Hill, In the Enemy's House by Howard Blum, It Happened on Broadway by Myrna Katz Frommer and Harvey Frommer, The Chelsea Effect by Arthur Miller, I Said Yes to Everything, a memoir by Lee Grant, Just Kids by Patti Smith, and Over Here, Over There by Maxine Andrews and Bill Gilbert. Despite early threats from the American Legion and the HUAC, New York's Broadway community proudly welcomed blacklisted artists to continue working in the theater. Many found refuge on the stage as opportunities in film, radio, and television dried up. Still, the impact of the blacklist, the many movies and television programs never made, the careers and lives ruined is immeasurable and remains a heartbreaking loss. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Chelsea Girls by Fiona Davis, with Kirsten Potter reading Hazel and Hilary Huber reading Maxine. This program was directed by John Doolittle. Executive Producer, Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 2019 by Fiona Davis. Production copyright 2019 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.